Well, hey, we are in this series, Navigating a Life of Faith. By the way, if you've been gone on vacation, you missed some amazing weeks, highly encourage you to catch up on them in the Crossroads app. We heard from Joel last weekend with the student takeover weekend. It was awesome. Then Paco before that, Chuck before that. Go back and catch up on the series. Now, navigating implies something. It implies that you know where you're going and you're course correcting the whole way to, in order to arrive at your intended destination. That's what navigation means. And I say that for my own benefit because I am navigationally challenged. Very, very much so. Horrible. One day I was in California recently. I was driving around and I don't know if you've ever been to California, but the road layout is basically spaghetti. Like, it's just, there's so many lanes, like 18 lanes, and they turn and they twist and they go over and they go under. And I'm trying to get to my destination. I'm in my car, I'm driving, and I've got the maps pulled up, right? And on the maps, I'm focused on one thing, the blue line. And I'm just trying to follow it. And I kept missing and I kept getting turned around. I was getting so frustrated. And so I called my wife. And husbands, you know that moment where you call your wife or you reach out and what you want is just some sympathy. You want to hear that you, even though things aren't going well for you, you're a competent adult and she believes in you and she's for you and it's probably Google Maps' fault, not yours, right? That is not what she said to me when I complained. She said, Kyle, have you ever looked at the giant green square that tells you where to go in the corner? Stop looking at the blue line. And I was like, I was not actually aware there was a green square. What are you talking about? And this is the moment that I realize in the world there are two kinds of people. There are blue spaghetti people and there are green box people. That is it. You are one or the other. Let me hear from my blue spaghetti people. Anybody a blue spaghetti person? You're just locked on that thing, right? You're just focused on it. You're just like just laser beamed in, but you don't actually know any of the road names or what direction to turn in. It's very difficult. Others of us were the green box people. We get locked into the green box and we're in it. But the problem that we have as green box people is that we have no idea what 1,000 feet is, right? You know, you actually have a theme song if you're a green box person. Check this out.
Dear Apple Maps, I don't know what 1,000 feet is.
Isn't that guy great? Spectacular. Amazing. So here's the point. To navigate well on roads, it turns out that you actually need both. You need to know where you're going. You need to follow the roads and the lines and the curves, and you need the wayfinding, the points and the signs. Both of those things add up to good navigation in the physical world. Well, the spiritual world is very similar. Do you know that there's actually two things you need to pay attention to if you want to navigate yourself to a life of faith? Which, by the way, that destination, I don't know what you imagine it to be, but in the Bible, it promises that that life of faith is dynamic and vibrant, that there's a source of belonging and purpose and love that you get when you actually arrive at the destination. It says there's two questions you need to hold on to get there, two key ones if you want to arrive. The first is, God, where are you in the bad? When life is hard, when it's disappointing, when it's painful, when things didn't go the way that I expected, when I prayed and I didn't get the answer that I wanted, everything from the annoying everyday stuff to the tragic stuff. That's the first one. The second one is like it, but the exact opposite. God, where are you in the good? Everything from the amazing little things that happen in the day, you find a dollar on the sidewalk, amazing, all the way up to the big things. You got the job. She said yes to marry you. God, where are you in those? And what I find is that all of us, we have a default. Just like the blue spaghetti people or the green box people, we are, generally speaking, defaulting to one of these two things. We're a focus on the bad person or we're a focus on the good person. There's not a better advantage starting spot, by the way. Each of them have their advantages. Each of them has their downsides. If you're default to the bad, you're prone to skip past the good. And what that means is that at best, you'll develop an intellectual connection to God. You might eventually see him as something like a distant king or distant ruler, but you will always struggle to embrace him as a loving father. That part will just never make sense because you're focused on the bad and not seeing any of the good. On the other hand, if your default mode is the good, you'll have another problem. You'll silver line everything. Get out your silver pen and just kind of outline every situation. You'll ignore all of the bad. And what that'll lead to, while in the moment you might have a good faith, you might have something that feels like a close connection, when life gets hard, and it will, you'll find that faith is very, very fragile. See, the way forward, if you want to arrive at the destination, is to embrace the tension of holding both at the same time. I hope my prayer is today in this service that you take a step in that direction. Before we go any further, let me pray for us. God, thank you so much for you. Thank you for being a God who invites questions. Thank you for being a God who even offers something called a life of faith, who offers purpose. And I'm asking for me and everyone in here that we take a step closer to you today. Amen. Now, like I said, today is about questions. Question asking, by the way, is a skill. And the skill has a name. It's called curiosity. And researchers have figured out that you hit your peak skill level as a curiosity person at the age of 4. No joke. That's when you're primed to be the most curious in your whole life. And I'll say, as a parent, my experience backs this up. I remember when my son Ben was 4, he was just started shouting from the bathroom. He goes, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, come here quick. You got to see this. You got to see this." And I was like, "Oh no, did the toilet blow up? You know, is water flooding everywhere? What's going on, buddy?" He goes, "Daddy, look at my poop. It's green, Daddy. Why is it green?" And I was like, "Wow." I looked at it. It was like, it was like Hulk took a dump in my toilet. Like, it was green, green. Here's a picture of it right here. Check it out. I'm just kidding. Some of you were like, "It's Crossroads. I really thought you were going to show a picture of it." No, we have taste. We have restraint. Plus, I couldn't find the picture, so. 4 years old. Now, at 4 years old, the thing is, kids don't know what's okay to ask, right? They just don't know. There's no filter set. My other son, Eli, when he was 4, he had his shirt off, and he walked up to me one day, and he goes, "Hey, Dad, why do boys have these?" And I was like, "I don't have a good answer, son. You're not supposed to ask these things. That's not okay. Not safe," right? But kids don't know. They have no filter. No one's taught them to be embarrassed yet. No one's taught them that asking a question could make them appear foolish or not smart or behind or not spiritual enough. No one's taught them that yet. See, as we age, as we grow, it changes. My son, Ben, he just turned 14 the other day. And I'll tell you, Ben still asks me questions, but not like the ones he used to. The questions he asks me now are things like, "Why?" You know, it's like every time I ask him to do anything, it's like he's afraid I'm in the FBI and he's being investigated. You know, he's like, "Ben, I need you to clean your room." "Why? Why would I do that?" Like, so suspicious. It's amazing. Not as cute as when they're 4. All of us, by the way, we have this transition in life. We go from asking unfiltered questions to eventually asking filtered ones. We stop asking in general, which is tragic. Do you know that one of the keys to success in life is actually the ability to remain curious, to keep asking questions? One of the greatest business gurus of the 20th century, maybe the greatest, was a guy named Peter Drucker. He was able to consult across industries and talk to CEOs in different nations and just a variety of from nonprofit world to corporate world, everybody he was able to relate to. And one time an interviewer asked him, they said, "Peter, how are you able to do that? How do you have the intellect to understand, to relate to all these different people?" And his answer was, "I ask questions." See, if you drop questions, you will find yourself less successful in life. The trick of it is to somehow retain that childlike quality, to become like a child. There was another researcher named Warren Berger. He wrote a book about this, about question askings, and he said this: "We must try to remain or rekindle the curiosity, sense of wonder, inclination to try new things, and the ability to adapt that has served us so well in childhood. We must become, in a word, neotenous. To do so, we must discover the tool that kids use so well in those early years, the question." Neotenous, by the way, not a new bad guy in X-Men. Not, if you thought that, that's what I thought at first. It means to retain childlike qualities even into adulthood. You must become like a child. which sounds very familiar to something that Jesus taught in Matthew 18. There was a time where the disciples were debating about who was the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, right? Who's the best, Jesus? Who's the greatest? And what he did is he took a child, brought him into the middle of the circle and said this, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." The greatest, to become like a child. Now, parents, we know something about kids, right? And let's all say it together at the same exact time, complete the sentence. Kids are kind of stupid. Is that why nobody, I thought we had a deal we were all going to say at the same time. Now I feel like I'm the bad guy because I had to say it out loud. Now relax, I don't mean like from an identity standpoint, children are beloved by God, all that stuff, yes, yes, yes. And my kids, multiple of them shoved crayons up their noses, okay? So not the height of intellect. And so it's worth asking, when Jesus says become like a child, does he mean become more naive? Does he mean become more simple-minded? Does he mean in order to have faith, you've got to somehow uncheck your adult brain and then just put it over on the side and then you can have a great time in faith world? Is that what he means? No. What he means is have the humility to ask your real, genuine questions. Jesus actually invites questioning. In Matthew 7:7, he said, "Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. And to the one who knocks, the door will be opened." Now that's an amazing promise, isn't it? He says, if you ask, he will answer. If you seek him, you will find him. Asking questions, by the way, that's called seeking God. It's going after him. At Crossroads, one of the labels that we've worn for a while, and I'll say proudly, is that we are a seeker church. That's terms is used to mean people who aren't yet sure that Jesus is who he says he is, but are seeking, are asking, are questionings. And a lot of times in Christian circles, it's used as a derogatory term, like we're dumbing things down or we're not giving the real truth or anything like that. But this is who we are at our core. Why? Well, because it turns out that seeking God is not a phase that you go through and you complete. Seeking God is the foundation of faith. In fact, if you want to kill your faith, the surest way to do it is to stop seeking God. Stop asking questions. Decide you've got it all figured out. That's the surest way to kill your faith. Seeking is a thing we're all supposed to be doing the entire time. There's a psalm, and I think it's Psalm 27. David, who is one of the chief people in the Old Testament of the Bible, David who defeated Goliath, he said that there's only one thing that he wants from God, only one thing that he desires, to dwell in the house of the Lord and to inquire in his temple forever. He literally goes, the only thing I want more than anything else is to just ask God questions forever and always. This is the foundation of faith, always has been, always will be. I just wonder about you, where you are in your seeking journey today. Have you stopped asking God questions? Have you had a moment where things got difficult? Maybe you started to ask, and maybe you didn't sense an answer, and so you stopped. Have you decided that you've got it all figured out? If so, today, restart seeking. If there's a gap between you and God, if you feel distance between you and God, I'm telling you, this could be why. You're not asking, you're not seeking. He says, if you seek, you will find. Here's the thing, though. You cannot seek God safely. It's impossible. It's not an option. You cannot seek him safely at all. The only way is to ask your real, dangerous, unfiltered questions. Now, I wanted to put this on a slide to make it more memorable for you guys because I think that helps, you know, with memory aid, like if you can see the words. And so I asked the guys to type this in on the slide. Seeking is asking dangerous, honest, real, noble, unfiltered, and sometimes emotionally charged questions, not the sanitized, safe, unsatisfying crap. Otherwise, you'll just get sanitized, safe, and unsatisfying answers. They told me look terrible on a slide, and I said, this is America. Let's try anyway. So this is it. This is a slide. And I'm not quite tall enough to have that as a slide. So we simplified it to seeking isn't safe. That's kind of point I want you to take home. Seeking is not safe, cannot be safe. Now, to be clear, there actually are two different ways to seek. There is a safe, easy way, and there's a difficult, hard way, an unsafe way. Two ways to seek. You know, a few verses after Jesus was saying, ask and seek, he said this, Matthew 7:13. He says, enter by the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction. Those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. There's two ways to go after God. There's two ways to explore. There's a hard way and there's an easy way. Two ways to seek. Now, the first way to seek God, the easy way, I'll call this the textbook method. Now, the textbook method of seeking says that God is a list of formal answers to memorize. He's just, if you can just find the right list, out of all the lists, which are many, by the way, there are 45,000 different denominations. There are 2.6 new denominations being born every single day. So finding the right list of answers is somewhat difficult, but imagine you can. The idea is that if you find that right list of answers, you mentally assent to them and you just never leave them. You just kind of hold on the rest of your life. The problem is the Bible doesn't turn out to have an annotated list of all of the answers to all of the questions. The Bible is not a list of answers. What it turns out to be is a list of hundreds and hundreds of stories of people, their antidotes and their hopes and their fears and their pain points and their mistakes and their successes and everything in between, the good moments in life and the terrible moments of life, all put together, hundreds of people over thousands of years, people who most often don't get the answer right at all, but whom God seems to love anyway. And so why do people pick the textbook method? Because it's safe and it's easy. You just pick your list and you stick to it. But another problem with this method is that if you choose the textbook method, you'll find the textbook God. He'll be neat. He'll be orderly. He'll fit into your box. He'll never disappoint you. He'll never do anything unexpected. You'll be able to answer every question on every test about him, but he will be wildly impersonal and therefore very difficult for you to love. This is the textbook God. If you feel distance between you and God, again, friend, I just want to gently ask you, is it because you've sought God the textbook way? Is it because years ago someone said, this is the list of the right answers, believe this, never question it? If so, I want to invite you into the other method of seeking God. Call it the unsafe, unfiltered method of seeking. And this is the way that every person in the Bible who's ever actually found God has sought him, unsafe. Here's a list of facts about my wife, Sarah. Sarah is an introvert. That's number one. Sarah also loves her people, two, and her alone time, three. Sarah also loves to run and hike. That's four and five. She's an amazing mom. That's six. And she's wicked smart. Notice there's no comma there. It wasn't wicked, comma, smart. Okay, it was wicked smart. Just in case she's watching, I love you. You're wicked smart. Very smart person, okay? Now, that is a list of facts about Sarah. Let me ask you a question. Do you know Sarah now? No, you don't know Sarah. You know some facts about Sarah, but knowing somebody is different than knowing facts about them. To truly know somebody, you spend tons of time with them and you ask them questions and you give them vulnerable answers, and it's a two-way street and it goes back and forth, and you don't suppress emotions. You don't squash things down. That's how you actually get to know someone. The problem is a lot of us have bought this religious lie that says that there are certain topics that are off limits with God. There are certain questions you can't ask him, that he would get upset with you if you were to express disappointment or anger or frustration or anything like that. And it's a tragedy because it's not at all what it says in the Bible. In fact, in the Bible, we see tons of examples of the exact opposite. People who aren't safe at all, who ask God real questions, even sometimes offensive questions. David, who I mentioned earlier, David and Goliath fame, he wrote another psalm, Psalm 13, at a low point in his life where it seemed like nothing was going right, nothing was breaking his way, everything was set against him. And he wrote this prayer to God. This is Psalm 13:1. He says, how long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? David actually levels accusations at God. God, you're hiding from me. God, you're forgetting me. And God doesn't hurl insults back at him. God doesn't say, how dare you, David? God doesn't put him in his place. Instead, God leans in and loves him and talks to him. In fact, David gets the title that is the best title any humans ever got outside of Jesus. It is a man after my own heart. That's what God says about David. And I'll say the same thing about you. Earlier in the service, we did that text-in moment, right? If you could ask God anything, what would you ask him? And I'd say 99% of those were questions about the pain points in our life, about the things where we've experienced disappointment, where we're currently experiencing difficulty or have these big, painful questions. And I just want you to know God welcomes every one of them. There wasn't a single one of those questions God saw and thought, man, I shouldn't have asked that. I think God's the loving Father who says, thank you for approaching me like a child who's willing to ask their father what's really on their mind. That's what he says. And I just want you to know I'm with you in that. Oh, I didn't have my phone with me. I don't have anywhere to put it. But if I had texted in, here's what I would have texted in. I would have said, God, why did my dad have a stroke? And will he ever get better? It's 2 weeks ago, I was in a meeting at Crossroads, work meeting. I was looking at the calendar for 2025, all the amazing events that we want to plan, all the ministry that we wanted to do. It's about 10 in the morning, 10:30, something like that. And my phone rings and it's my older sister. She does not usually call at 10:30 on Tuesdays. So I ignored it, silenced it, I'll get to her later. And then about 30 seconds later, my younger brother called. And that's when I thought, something might be wrong. So I picked up the phone and answered, and he said, hey, Dad right now is having a stroke. He's in the garage, the ambulance is on the way. Pray, and we need to go. And so I packed everything up and I ran to the airport. By the way, I put a prayer into the Crossroads app, and I know there were so many of you who prayed for my family and for my dad, and I just want to say thank you for that. It means the world to me, and we did see God show up. We saw amazing things happen to him. When it started, he was paralyzed on his right side. And we spent days in the hospital working and figuring out what's going on, and he's made a lot of progress. And there's still a long way to go. He's suffering from something called conduction aphasia, where the words and the ideas don't quite connect in his mind. He struggles to understand words and to express himself. He's in therapy and getting better. But that's my question. God, will my dad ever be the same? Again, I just want you to know, if all you need to hear today is that it's okay to ask God what you really want to know, what's really on your mind, just take it home with you, because it is. There's nothing he wants more than to hear what you're actually thinking. It doesn't make you unfaithful. It doesn't make you bad. It doesn't make you dumb. It doesn't make you stupid. It just means you're human and you're willing to admit it. It's okay. But I also want you to know if that all you do is focused on the bad, if the only thing you ever do is ask God, why did X, Y, and Z bad thing happen, you're prone to convert to a different religion. It's what I think is the fastest growing faith in the world. It's called cynicism. It's not my idea, by the way, that that's the fastest growing. I'll do that in a second. And it's been around for a long time. It actually goes back to a Greek word from a long, long time ago. The Greek word is kunikos. And what it literally means is dog-like. Now, not like your cute dog. You know, you've got your fuzzy cute dog or whatever. Not your cute dog, like a wild dog. It is the dog-eat-dog mentality or worldview that says that everything is meaningless. It says expect disappointment because it's probably coming. So one of its central religious ideas is that if something good happens, it's either because of your own effort or just random chance and random luck. There's nothing else behind it or to it, and it is growing. I did a Google search about this and just compared one way to look at it, which is basically how often is the word used? And Google lets you do these searches. And I searched for cynicism, which is on the rise, and then Christianity as a contrast. And you can see it's on the decline. Cynicism is growing. More and more researchers are picking up on this, by the way. It's across, not just in America, it's across the entire world. And what they're discovering is that cynicism will destroy you. A lot of research has been done. There was one guy who wrote an article in the Harvard Business Review recently, and he said this: too much cynicism can become toxic at every level. Individually, cynics earn less money over the course of their lives and are more likely to experience depression and are at a greater risk of heart disease than non-cynics are. Despite its dire consequences, cynicism appears to be on the rise. And this author, he's not alone. I found other research and other studies that said cynical people are more likely to get dementia, cancer, make less money, have a more difficult time in forming and maintaining romantic relationships. In other words, if cynicism were a product, none of us would buy it. We'd be like, why in the world would I ever want that? And yet, it's on the rise. So the question is, why? And the answer that sociologists are pointing to is an effect that they call the cynical genius illusion. And it's this belief that somehow has crept into our brains that says the safest, wisest thing to do as a human is to protect against disappointment by expecting the worst at all times. We actually think that that's wise, but it's not. Another researcher, a woman out of a university in the Netherlands, did some research on this, just kind of going like, well, if this is what most people think, which they do, is it true? She wrote this. A further three studies based on the data of about 200,000 individuals from 30 countries debunked these beliefs as illusionary by revealing that cynical versus less cynical individuals generally do worse on cognitive ability and academic competency tasks. Do worse. Cynicism is the allure of the day, and it will kill you. It will tank your life. See, God says, yes, 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 ask me where the bad comes from, but please, 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 don't forget to ask me about the good. Don't forget to ask me about the good. You know, there's this weird thing that we humans do, right? When bad things happen, we immediately go to the higher power. Well, God, where were you? We don't tend to attribute it to our choices or random chance. But when good things happen, we do the opposite. We never go, oh, this must be God. Instead, we go, well, this must be random luck, or maybe I'm just great at stuff. And what God's asking is to say, hey, please hold the tension of both. Yes, let's talk about the bad, but please, can we also talk about the good? Can we ask this question too? Because God proposes that he's not just a distant king. He's not just a sovereign power working his plan. He's a loving father who wants to give you good, good gifts. Good gifts. James 1:17. It says, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. Every good and perfect gift. Parents, if you want a pro tip, teach this verse to your kids. Make it the first ones that they've ever heard. Sarah and I did this years ago. We taught it to our kids and just said, hey guys, everything you have that's good, everything is actually from God. Do you know that? And it's something we reinforce with them all the time. You said it again last night. Hey guys, what's something good? Was it the ice cream cone you had today? Do you know that wasn't random? That's a gift from God. Was it good? The vacation that you got to have, was that good? Well, then it's a gift from God. See, there are good things in your life. If you're willing to ask, where are they? You'll find yourself lifted above the noise of cynicism, pulled out of its gravitational orbit, up to higher places where you can see and find the life that God has for you. So I'll say right now, I'm in this tension. I'm sad about my dad. I'm asking God questions. Why did this happen? Is he ever gonna be okay? Where were you in this? All those sorts of things. And I'm looking at the good and saying, God, where did this come from? Was this you? And there's good in my life at the same exact time. One of the goods, my dad had his stroke in an attic workout room in his house, up 18 stairs, huge staircase. His right side got paralyzed, but somehow he was able to make it down 18 stairs without falling, crawl across the garage, and yell for my mom, who happened to be in the one room of the house that you could actually hear him in that spot. And he was able to get help right away. That's good. That's good. And I'm able to say, God, thank you for that good. I don't believe that was random. I don't believe that was chance. I don't believe that was luck. I don't believe that's because their architect built the house in a certain way. I believe that's because you're a loving father who has good things even in the midst of the pain. Another moment that's good. Another moment that was really, really good. With my son, you know, obviously in a spot where father-son stuff is particularly tender with me right now. I got to have an amazing moment with my son, who loves baseball, who made the Little League All-Star team as a catcher. I got to throw out the first pitch of the Reds game to my son and have him catch it. It was good. And miraculously, I threw a strike. I don't know how that happened. That's God is good. So good. Another one. My boys are going to camp next week. Middle school camp at Crossroads. Can't wait for it. They are so excited. That's good. When they get in the car and they ask to put on their music, do you know what they want to play? Worship music. Why? Because of the impact of Crossroads students on them. That's good. That's not random. That's not an accident. That's a good father who loves me. And so even in the midst of it, I'm saying to God, God, you are good. And I just want to say thanks. I want to hold on to the tension of both of them. And I'm telling you, your temptation is going to be to let go of one. Because there are times if you wade into the tension of holding on to the questions without the answers, of the good and the bad at the same time, of the beauty and the pain, you'll find that sometimes it wants to pull your arms apart. But when you hold this posture, you're holding the posture of the cross. You know the cross was the best good to ever happen? It was the time where humanity was redeemed, where all of the sin, all of the mistakes, all of everything can get washed away for anyone who believes, and it's the worst bad that's ever happened. The most innocent man in the history of the universe brutally murdered, the most unjust moment in the history of the world. It is the bad and it is the good at the same time. In the challenge of faith, if you want to navigate yourself to the life of faith, you must embrace and hold on to both of them.